Welcome, dear listener, to Let's Dig Deeper, the podcast where we talk all about archaeology, history, art, and culture. My name is Zinat Haroun. I am a student of classical archaeology at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. And on this podcast, I'm going to take you along for interviews with some of the delightful people working in the field. And we'll talk with archaeologists, art historians, professionals, and more. Hopefully, we'll learn more about the past in the process. And today is a very special episode. I've traveled all the way from my studio in Copenhagen to Athens, Greece. And I'm here at the Danish Institute in Athens, or DIA as it's called, in a makeshift studio. So if you hear any scooters passing by or the faint background hum of the AC, that's why. And during these special episodes, we'll be talking to some of the most interesting scholars and experts that Athens has to offer. And my guest today is Rasmus Sivilstil. Welcome, Rasmus.
Thank you.
And Rasmus, you are a scholar of classical Greek and Latin, and you hold a PhD from the University of Copenhagen, where you've also held a research position. Beyond that, you've also researched at Cambridge before joining the Danish Institute here in Athens, where you are the vice director. Your research interest lies especially in the works of Plato, and you've also translated the works of other classical authors like Sappho. And today we're taking a closer look at Plato's philosophy, and specifically we're going to be talking about his views on art and culture. But before we get to that, I think we should just quickly establish some background information about Plato for those out there who are not familiar with him. So can you give us a short introduction to Plato and why he's so important?
I can try at least. So Plato was born here in Athens around 428. He came from an aristocratic family, received a good education, which was at that time musical education, education in poetry, and gymnastics. We know that he had two brothers and a sister, and he grew up at a time in Athens when it was particularly challenging time. It was a Peloponnesian War that was what must have defined most of his childhood. And it's also a time of sort of the late 5th century, a time of intellectual flourishment in different ways. You had like various forms of art, tragedy developed throughout the 5th century. You had sophists, rhetoricians, various people coming in and out of Athens, which had become this like the center of intellectual life in most of Greece. But that, in some ways at least, ended when Athens lost the Peloponnesian War. So that must have been what defined Plato in various ways. And then he was, of course, as many people will know, a student of Socrates, this very famous, very charismatic intellectual who was also provocateur in many ways, who walked around just down here on the agora, asking people questions, looking for various forms of moral truths, asking about the good life, asking about what justice is, what virtue is, that kind of questions. And Plato must have followed him from fairly early on. We don't know the details, but we know that he was in the inner circle at around the time when Socrates was accused of corrupting the minds of the young Athenians and for impiety, worshipping false gods and failing to worship the gods of Athens, and he was executed in 399. So that must also have been a shock for this still young Plato.
Yeah, to have his teacher executed like that.
Yeah. And this, of course, follows at a time of political turmoil in Athens. At the end of the Peloponnesian War, you had these conservative and democratic factions fighting each other. So really, really challenging. And probably we should say something about Plato. He goes on to live until 348, around that time. So he lives to be 80.
Yeah. Quite old.
Quite old. And he sets up an academy. This is after the death of Socrates. Probably he came into some money, some inheritance, and he set up what we now know of as the academy, just northwest of the old city walls. We can walk out there from here. We were sitting at the center of Athens in like 20 minutes. So he had a house there. There was a gymnasium, like sort of a sports field there where people would train, which would also often be sort of a place of intellectual conversation. But during the time Plato had the academy, it became like more of a formal institution, and people would travel to his academy to sort of discuss philosophy with.
The gymnasium part of it is also really interesting to me, because most people might not know this, but Plato himself was also a wrestler. He wasn't like, if you just imagine this philosopher type person, what you might think of. He was actually a very active sportsman in his own time, right?
I mean, at least as a child, he grew up with this education that was consisted of learning to recite poetry, play the lyre, and gymnastics. So that would be like wrestling, all that kind of stuff that went on.
All right. Well, thank you for that introduction to Plato. I think now we have a clearer picture of who he is. Now let's dig deeper. So, Plato was a great philosopher, and he had a lot of views on a lot of different things, but today we're picking just one aspect to focus on, namely his views about art and culture. But I think it's important that we have some context for his views before we examine them a bit deeper. So maybe you can tell us a bit about Plato's so-called theory of forms. What was that concept about?
Yeah, so that's his really famous sort of metaphysical theory, his theory about the constitution of the world, if you like. And we find that sort of mostly developed in what we call the middle dialogue. So that would be dialogues like The Republic, very famous work, The Phaedo, The Phaedrus, The Symposium. And the basic idea is that there's a world you can see, the world we perceive with our senses. And then there's a world we can only get to through reasoning, through philosophy. You might take the example of a chair, the chair we're sitting on now. We both sit on different chairs, and there are many chairs here besides us. So what is it that makes a chair a chair? That's the basic question. If you're going to define a chair, you move away from the individual chair, the chair you can touch, to a more theoretical construct, which for Plato would be more real than the actual chair. So once we start theoretical inquiry into the nature of things, we're no longer talking about specific things in the world. We're talking about something abstract. And for Plato, that underlying abstract reality of things is also what made things what they are.
So it's the essence of things, or the true form of something.
Yes. So, I mean, there's a lot of debate about this. Some people would say that it's actually essences. Some people would say that they're like some kind of ideal exemplars. But in all of these cases, we have to understand them as theoretical constructs. And one thing is, when we're talking about a chair and the form of a chair as different things, they have different ontological status. They are sort of different kinds of things.
Mm.
Another thing is when, and this is surely sort of where Plato is headed with all of this, what happens when we talk about things like justice, things like goodness, beauty.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing we can see, as he would say, in other things. But what about justice itself? What about beauty itself? What about goodness itself?
So things that don't necessarily have a physical materialization.
Exactly. So they're only materialized in other things.
Okay.
But they're also, in a way, what make other things good and just and so on and so forth. And if you think about what I said before, that Socrates was Plato's teacher. Socrates is very famous for sort of turning philosophy away from theories about what the world is, to the moral realm. What is justice? What does it mean to be a good person? What is a good life?
Mm.
And Plato, in a way, sort of combines that with a theory about the world in which these very abstract notions of absolute justice, which are very real things for him, they are also things that can be reached theoretically, not through the senses.
Okay.
So you, like the chairs, all of a sudden, it's a very easy example, right? But
yeah.
if you then think about goodness, justice, beauty, all that, moral qualities,
yeah.
Think about those in terms of theory. And you might think, actually, the only way to sort of establish in a firm way what goodness is through philosophy. That's how we find out what it is.
Because you can't physically see it.
You can't physically see it. You can only see good things in the world.
Well, I can see how people have debated this for a long time.
Yes.
Okay. So a bit more confused now, but let's see what we find out.
Sorry about that.
No, I think this is why it's important to talk about it, because these concepts are otherwise not really something that is accessible or that people think about, like to examine further, because at the surface level, it can already be so hard to understand. But we will figure it out today. So Plato used his theory of forms as a foundation for his criticism of art. And he talks about art as a mimicry of reality. So art to him is a copy of a copy. Like if I make a drawing of the chair, for example, then that drawing is a copy of the chair, which is already a copy of, let's just say, the essence of what a chair is. And so therefore, the result that art would be is therefore removed from the actual fabric of reality, the forms. And why was this an issue for him?
I think the different ways of answering that question. And I think we need to sort of take the context in which he sort of presents this theory. And this happens in book 10 of The Republic. So this major work of his, which is about a just and happy society.
Mm.
And he has discussed poetry, especially in this work, and he returns to it. So his beef is really with poetry.
Okay.
but he does mention the artist. That's true. And the artist becomes sort of the painter, especially, becomes the paradigm of all arts. So one thing that's going on there is thinking about what kind of things artistic images are,
yeah.
Whether they're in poetry, whether they're visual, whether it's statues, whether it's music.
Mm.
And it's not necessarily in itself critical to think that way. Like, if you think that the world is, in essence, not necessarily a copy, but an image of a theoretical world that underlies yeah. all of the world we see, then what are images that present human beings, say?
Just a copy of a copy.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, and if we say representation rather than copy, we might get to at least like part of his thinking. They can just copy, but they can also represent in a certain way, but they do it in a different way. So one way of understanding this is that he's getting at the difference between the thing itself and the image.
Mm.
And what is an image? How does it relate? Because it does have something to do with what it presents, but it isn't the thing.
Yeah.
So that I personally think is sort of quite interesting. And it seems to be happening right there. Sort of. And of course, Plato is here a product of his own culture. Like, there are all these images and immense artistic
expression
and development and innovation in Athens where he lives. And he wants to think about what kind of things these images are.
Yeah.
So he does that in a very philosophical way. And what he's getting at in the Republic especially is that traditionally poetry would be used as education. And actually in his ideal city, it is still that. So there's this sort of popular notion that he banishes all the artists. It's not quite true because he banishes important poetic genres, tragedy, Homeric epic, hugely important.
Yes.
But there's still the citizens in his ideal city will still be raised on poetry.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So not all poetry is bad to him.
Not all poetry is bad to him.
Okay. What does he let stay? What does he keep? Does he just keep the concept of like a censored version of poetry or what?
Yes, exactly
okay.
that. A censored version of poetry. And I think if we want to think about the connection between his sort of philosophical, metaphysical theory and what we call the epistemic theory, so how we understand things and its relation to the critique of the arts, we can see some connection there because one of his problems is that because creating an image is different from creating the real thing, which in itself, if you think of it only in terms of like technical skill, these are different activities. We have to grant him that, right?
Creating a chair and drawing a chair are two different things.
Yeah, they're two, exactly.
Mm.
So when you live in a society where poets are also educators, and if you think that what it means to be a good person is not subjective, it's quite objective because it's founded in a metaphysical reality, then you want to make sure that children are raised on true, as he would put it, images of virtue and not some, you know, some poetic fancy.
False idealized version of the world. Uh-huh.
And that's where sort of poetry becomes difficult for him because he sees in the culture around him how tragedy has become hugely popular. Tragedy was an art form. You could win. There was competitions. So.
Yes.
And what he criticizes the tragic poets for is to cater to the audience. So they present as good what the audience want to see as good. So it has to give them pleasure. It has to sort of be nice. Maybe they want a lot of emotion. You know, they want to be moved in different ways. But for Plato, that is sort of failing to do what art should be doing. It should sort of show us what ideal people do, not just...
entertain us.
Not just entertain us, exactly.
Okay. And Plato also pondered the dangers of art, and he believed that art could have a harmful impact on society and on the individual. As you say, when a society is raised on a certain type of media, I guess, then that obviously affects the way that they act and make decisions. And he meant that art had the power to deceive its viewer and instill false and idealized views of reality into a person. And today, where art is rapidly evolving and technology like AI is changing the way we interact with our own reality, I can't help but see some sense in these views that he held. And I'm sure by now we've all seen so-called AI art and deepfake videos that are so realistic, but yet seem so far removed from the actual reality, from the actual truth. So do you think that we are, in a way, facing some of the exact dangers that Plato warned against?
I think we have been facing it for a while. I think there's a way of, if we sort of bracket for a while, that he banished tragedy, which is something that most of us like and think is like a profound art form, et cetera, et cetera. And we look at him as someone who was really critical of mass media, mass culture. There's sort of a famous piece that has been written on this. It's like, we should really see it as a critique of mass media rather than art with a capital A. And if we do that, and if we think about his wariness, let's put it that way, of these transparent media, then I think there is something that relates to the role. And I would perhaps see this like more as a sort of gradual development that has happened, especially sort of in the 20th century, with especially film and photography. I've had a sort of niche interest in people who have been inspired by Plato in the 20th century. And there is a connection between Plato and critical theory. People like Brecht, famously, who was a playwright in the sort of first half of the 20th century German. And he was very keen on breaking the illusion in theater, because when we're like watching a play, when we're identifying so strongly with a character, you're also susceptible to sort of taking in the values. And this is exactly, and I think Brecht knew that, that's exactly Plato's critique. Mm. And that sort of spills into like the other sort of famous philosopher, Adorno, who's like very into aesthetic theory, Benjamin. They all make this connection with Plato. And what characterizes them is that they're very wary both of capitalism, which they saw in Hollywood. So we might be susceptible to the values when we watch a Hollywood film without, we might know, but we might still not know the impact it has on us. Mm. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, they also grew up with fascism. So you could also see how this new media that was film could impact.
Could be utilized in a harmful way.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they wanted a different kind of art, one that doesn't sort of pacify you, as they would see it. One where you don't have to be the spectator only, but would also sort of shock you in different ways, make you aware that you're watching a play, a film, and in that way, try to
disconnect you
and raise you of critical thinking. And it's sort of like that way, like not everyone would agree with this, but I like that way of looking at Plato as someone who is very aware that something happens in this identification, in tragedy especially, with a character, and that it leaves us open to
manipulation,
looking at the world through their eyes, being susceptible to their values, stuff like that. Mm. And I think one maybe more interesting and more recognizable modern critic is Laura Mulvey, who is behind some of the critical theory on male gaze. Mm. And if you read her essay, it's quite clear that there's some connections with Plato, because she's very aware of the ways in which Hollywood made you sort of identify with certain hero, certain protagonists, and in doing that, also take pleasure in what the protagonist takes pleasure in. So there's like this whole way of looking that's going on there.
Yeah, you adopt the same view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we're more sympathetic to that way of thinking now than people were maybe 30 years ago. And I do think that there is a connection between these. We might not agree with Plato's critique. I don't think a lot of people share his taste. But we might see that he's onto something in that critique of tragedy, especially.
Yeah, I feel like his suspicion of art, maybe not capital A art, can be used to manipulate other people. I think that's definitely something that's still relevant to how we think about art today. Mm-hmm. But it's not just, as you already said, it's not just art in the form of sculpture and painting that Plato grapples with. He's also at odds with poetry. And in his work, The Phaedrus, he considers the concept of poetry as a theomania, or divine madness. What does he mean by this?
Yeah, good question. In the Phaedrus, he's looking at different kinds of what he calls mania, eros, desire. Love is a different kind of mania that can sort of take you to different insights that aren't specifically philosophical. Because normally we would say that Plato is thinking of insight as something you can only get through very rigorous philosophical argument. Mm. But there it seems like he's open to the idea that you can actually sort of chance on something true. But it belongs to that story as well, that he doesn't grant that insight to the poet. So it's more an ideal of poetry as inspiration that might yield something that's actually true. But the poet is, you know, like more of a prophet who doesn't know what they're saying.
More like a medium.
Yes, exactly.
Divine inspiration, yeah. I guess. Uh-huh.
And so here, he would still call the poet here a mimetes, an imitator.
Yeah.
Who just voices these visions, as it were. But the Phaedrus is an interesting text when it comes to that, and because it seems also that in the whole setting of it, Socrates mentions the protagonist, Socrates. It's Socrates who's like...
Yeah, Socrates voicing. Is always Plato's protagonist.
In these dialogues, yes. So Plato lets his character, Socrates, his old teacher, but in this case a character, talk about the beautiful setting. They're outside the city, which is unusual in this particular dialogue. And he mentions the love poets in the beginning. And it does seem like he's open to the insight that poets can have in describing love.
So he grudgingly acknowledges that poetry does have some virtue in it, perhaps.
Yeah, and I think for the reasons mentioned earlier, I'm one of the people who think that Plato might be more accepting of poetry than he's usually given credit for. So it's quite clear that he doesn't think poets have moral insight, which is the whole problem, right? But he also recognizes that poetry is really important in the education of people. And perhaps the reason why he's so critical of some of it is that he thinks it's really important.
And it could be even better.
It could be much better, especially like when you compare to tragedy and all that. But like in his ideal city, you have sort of the philosopher to oversee this whole institution that's poetry. And there, poetry must have the ability to show you something, like ideal types or something like that. Not the forms, but...
It should have a purpose more than just entertainment. Okay. So in this context, when divine madness is sort of the catalyst for humans to gain these powerful true insights, does that mean that not all art is bad to Plato then?
Yeah, I think it does. For Plato, it's all about what you do with it in a way. So it's not that you get insight from poetry directly, but it might represent something that can lead you to insight. I think that's how we need to think of it in the Phaedrus as well. And I think the problem, one of the problems, there are many problems, but one of the problems with tragedy, sort of it appeals to a part of you that isn't interested in learning, isn't interested in philosophy. Whereas you can imagine other forms of art, other forms of poetry, they make you ask questions, they make you wonder. And here we sort of back to sort of what is an image. So I think personally that part of what's going on with tragedy is not only what it represents, it's also how it does it. So one of the things with that kind of image is that it presents as reality. Like when you go into the theater, you want to be deceived.
Yeah, you actively seek out deception.
Exactly, in order to be entertained. But you can also imagine a different kind of art and poetry where you look at the work of art with more sort of contemplation. You think about what does this represent? How does it relate to something? How is this an image? And you're aware of it as a representation. You don't sort of want to take it as reality. And all of a sudden, that takes you somewhere, which is what it's all about for Plato.
You start thinking.
Plato's own writing is full of utopian images, or images that are meant to sort of estrange you from the world. In the Republic, he has his famous cave allegory.
Yes.
And there we're sort of told, imagine that some people who are like in a cave, sitting, facing a wall, there's a fire behind them, and they're only seeing the shadows playing. And then the interlocutor says, well, that's a strange image. And then Socrates says, well, it's just Agos. And this whole image is sort of created to make us think about our own reality in a different way. And you can see how that can't be sort of philosophically a bad thing, right? So you can have, I think, along those lines.
Yeah, so Plato, in fact, actually also utilizes art himself, or at least artistic images or descriptions to make his point known, which I believe then would be a valid use of art if you learn something from it, at least.
Yeah.
Okay. And if Plato was alive today, what kind of art forms do you think he would critique or perhaps even embrace?
So if we think about what we talked about now, there's definitely a critique of mass culture and also a critique of the way in which our own sort of political world becomes, he has this famous expression in the Laws where he calls what's going on in theaters a theatrocracy. And there is something about like the way everything becomes performance in Athens around the time that he's very critical of. So I think if you sort of look at the way the entertainment industry works today, I think you'd be critical of it. I think he'd be very critical of, you know, like the Netflix algorithm that just like gives you what you already...
Keeps feeding you entertainment.
Yes, yeah. I think he'd be critical of that. I think he'd be critical of the way art is used politically. I mean, I don't think that sort of the notion of, I don't know, art, if you go to a museum, I don't see how he could be against that.
No. I think he would like documentaries. Those would be entertaining for him.
Yeah. But I also want to grant him more. So another way of asking, what would he like in his own days? He would like hymns, lyric poetry. He would also perhaps, there is a passage in The Sophist where he talks about different kinds of visual art. And there it seems like what he doesn't like is very sort of realistic art. So, you know, what we know as classical art, but he would be more prone to the archaic.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, but you can see how that, in a way, that also presents you with types more than individuals. It's also something that is very, sort of, it presents as an image, not as reality.
Yeah, archaic art, for example, the Koros is statues that are very identical. If you see one, you've seen all, basically, whereas classical art is very much more dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The archaic art has a more sort of schematic expression. There's something abstract in it that I think would have appealed to him, maybe. And I think definitely all kinds of art that do not try to hide themselves as reality. So
yeah. So he would love every time a play breaks the fourth wall, basically.
I mean, yes. I think he would prefer that.
We've now talked about Plato's own philosophy and his own views, but what impact did his philosophy have on later perception of art and its influence on culture and society?
So I don't think it's underestimating Plato to say that he is like one of the, I don't know, top two philosophers in the sort of most influential philosophers in European history. It's so foundational. Mm. Plato is so foundational that you can hardly sort of underestimate the way he has sort of shaped our way of thinking. And when it comes to art, and something we haven't actually talked about, but I'll get it in here. The whole thing about like being a copy of a copy is, he calls it mimesis. So it's mimetic of the thing it sort of represents or imitates. And that way of thinking about art is very foundational, can hardly escape it. So there's something about thinking. So he's really the first to contemplate what an image is. And he does it in a way that is just, it's foundational for sort of European thinking anyway.
Mm. Yeah, so we can really actually sort of separate Plato's views from the way we might view art and culture today. They're so intertwined.
They're so intertwined.
Yeah, okay.
And in the Arabic tradition as well was also very heavily Platonized. So like the discussions about images, idolatry in Christian Arab traditions also lead back very directly to Plato. So I don't think we would think about images the way we do if it wasn't for Plato.
Well, that's really significant. That's a lot of credit then.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. You've hinted a bit at it so far, but what are your own views on the influence of art on humans? I mean, you seem to agree with Plato on some bits of it, but what do you think?
I don't know how much I agree. I think it's always more interesting to see if Plato might have been right than to just reject it as wrong, because it's always sort of interesting to have your own views challenged and sort of the role we give to culture today. It's sort of interesting to think with him about that, I think. My own view, yeah, now I'm hesitating.
You can share it, it's a safe space.
So I think we live in a different culture. So for Plato, it was like the basis of education in a way that it isn't quite anymore. But on the other hand, I also tend to agree with people who think that it's sort of the only place, maybe philosophy is another, it's the only place where we sort of get a different kind of language. So if we don't want, and this goes back to some of the things that I've been talking about, but if we want to sort of imagine a world differently, if we want to sort of think about it differently, if we want to have our categories challenged, which is really sort of the basis of our perception of reality, I think we do need to look at art. We need to read poetry. We need to read novels. We need to sort of think about the world in a different way. And I personally, and I'm glad you say this is a safe space, but I think that I would very much like to see more people, including politicians, look at more art, read more poetry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that's a controversial view at all. I think you're right when you say that art used to be such a bigger part of an education, and now it is like barely an elective in most countries. And I also think it's interesting how, even though we live in such a time of mass media and mass communication, as you say, and art is so easily accessible nowadays, much more so than it must have been at least just a century earlier, it's interesting how much we consume art, yet don't reflect upon it as much as you might have done in the past. So maybe there's also a critique in there somewhere about mass consumerism. So before we finish this episode, let's just do a quick summary. Key takeaways from this conversation. If there's one thing in particular you'd like our listeners to take with them from what we've talked about of Plato's views.
Okay, so I think the main point would be that Plato didn't hate all art, but he was highly critical of it.
Not all art is bad.
Not all art is bad, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, perfect. I don't think I've ever given this much thought to ancient philosophy, but I already feel much wiser than before this episode. So maybe Plato was onto something. And Rasmus, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been great having you.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, dear listener, for tuning in to this episode of Let's Dig Deeper. I hope you've learned lots. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, you can reach us at letsdigdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that is letsdigdeeperpodcast@gmail.com or on Instagram at letsdigdeeperpodcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on your preferred platform so you never miss an episode. I am Zinat Haroon and I've been your host. You can reach me on Instagram at z_archaeology. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time where we will dig deeper into another topic. Bye!